This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining me this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. In the summer of 1940, Britain and Northern Europe were under attack from Nazi Germany. The U.S., meanwhile, remained neutral. It was illegal for Americans to join the fight in Europe. The penalties included prison and loss of citizenship. On the program today, we'll hear about seven Americans who defied the law, joined the RAF, and fought in the Battle of Britain, a battle described as the greatest air battle in history. Our guest is writer and historian Alex Kershaw. He is the author most recently of The Few, The American Knights of the Air Who Risked Everything to Fight in the Battle of Britain. Alex Kershaw is the author of five books, including biographies of Jack London and Robert Capa. He is also the author of The Bedford Boys, a book about an infantry company on D-Day, and The Longest Winter, a book about a platoon in the Battle of the Bulge. His latest book, The Few, The Knights of the Air Who Risked Everything to Fight in the Battle of Britain, is published by DeCaprell Press. Alex Kershaw, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Great to be with you.
This is the third book you've written that tells stories of people during World War II, people who are at once ordinary and extraordinary. What led you to your interest in these stories of the war?
Do you want the absolutely honest answer, which is that when I was a boy in England, I found a huge stash of illustrated magazines and comics about the Second World War. And one of my earliest memories is of sitting in my grandparents' shed at the back of their garden and literally eating this stuff up for an entire summer. So I think that's the beginning of my fascination with the period. I would trace it back to then. I've just always been very interested in this particular period of history. The context is just a wonderful one in which to write about average people, ordinary people.
Did you talk with your grandparents about this period of history?
I did, yes. I remember being regaled with stories about the Second World War. It was interesting because my mother's mother, my grandmother, she lost her husband in the early part of the Second World War. He was a telegraphist in the Navy and died of his wounds. He was part of the convoy runs that tried to Malta alive, and he went into the water, got badly injured, and died of gangrene before my mother was born. So I've always known that my own mother never knew her father because she never got to see him. So that was one side of the family, and the other side of the family, my grandmother's next husband, after she remarried, had a very good war. He was in the RAF, the Royal Air Force. And he claimed ran the black market in Egypt for downed air parts, downed, you name it. If you wanted to get it, got it from my adopted grandfather.
He was a colorful guy. So what was your introduction to the story of the Americans you profile in The Few?
Well, I was looking for a good story and a good Second World War story that hadn't been told before, and there's not many left that are really exciting, and I look all the time, and I thought, well, here's this wonderful story that all of us Brits know about. We've grown up on the legend of the Battle of Britain, but a lot of Americans don't know that much about. And the way to get an American readership and audience interested in this wonderful story is to have the characters be American. And when I discovered that seven Americans, a kind of magnificent seven, actually went over and flew in the Battle of Britain, I thought, wow, why not write a group biography of these? And that will hopefully provide a really good human angle on what is a really great story.
Yeah. As a group, what were they like?
They were very different. One guy, Billy Fisk, was the youngest ever gold medal winner in the Winter Olympics. He won for the bobsled. International sophisticate, a real playboy. He won actually his second gold medal at age 20, first at 16, the second at 20, and carried the stars and stripes at the opening ceremonies of the 1932 Lake Placid Winter Olympics. So he was a real celebrity in his own time, the greatest bobsledder that that there ever was, in fact. And then on the other extreme would be a guy called Art Donoghue, who was born on a farm in St. Charles, Minnesota, and went from flying above his dad's cornfields to just 3 weeks later having a very determined German ace on hail trying to kill him. So very, very, very wild. One thing they had in common was they were crazy, they were wild, but also they were obsessed with flying to the point where they would lose their own citizenship to go and fight in a war that wasn't theirs. But in that war, they would get to fly the Supermarine Spitfire, which was the most beautiful and elegant plane these young men had ever set eyes on. Mm.
And one of the seven was from Illinois.
Sure, absolutely. Actually, Billy Fisk, the gentleman I just mentioned, he was born in Chicago. He left Chicago when he was 11 to go to Paris, where he was largely educated. But the other guy is a guy called Philip LaCrone. And if you fly from Chicago to Salem, Illinois, when you get out at the airport, you'll see a sign, which is the Philip LaCrone Airport. It's the airport in Salem is named after this gentleman. And his story is basically that he left his young wife and two young children to go and fly in the Battle of Britain. And in doing so, really, it was the end of his marriage, because as his wife pointed out, why on earth was he abandoning his wife and family to go and fight in a war and in the process lose his citizenship? And if he then tried to come back to America, he would almost certainly have been thrown into jail and or fined a huge amount of money.
Yeah. In this book, we have the story of men who defied the neutrality laws. Why were they enacted? When were they enacted? What should we know about them?
Well, they were passed in the late 1930s, specifically to stop any Americans from joining an armed service of a warring power. And they reflected a deeply felt and widespread sense of isolationism within America. Leading figures such as Lindbergh, the great pilot, Joseph Kennedy, the American ambassador in London, and several very powerful senators in the Midwest, mainly, were big isolationists. They had a large audience, and America was really not in the mood to enter into a world conflagration. Just one generation after the First World War, it was a country that didn't want to be involved in the war.
Yeah. The Few opens in May of 1940. What was the situation at that point in Britain and Northern Europe?
It was desperate. Winston Churchill became Prime Minister on the 10th of May, 1940. In a matter of a couple of months, just 2 months, the Nazi war machine, the like had never been seen before, had stormed through every democracy in Northern Europe. France had fallen in 6 weeks. It was a devastating example of what the Germans called blitzkrieg, lightning war, and Britain stood alone. Britain was the only country, the only democracy in Europe which was not fascist, which had not fallen to the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe. Only 23 miles of the English Channel separated Britain from becoming a slave state, from the fate of all the other occupied countries. And at Dunkirk, mm-hmm. In June of 1940, the British had managed to bring off most of their expeditionary force that was in France. They had salvaged their men from France, but they hadn't been able to bring back any armament. And so Churchill, in the first weeks of his premiership, stood up and said in the Houses of Parliament, now it is down to the RAF. Now it's down to just 2,500 young men to defend civilization, what remains of the free world. And he said that, and in the same breath said, until the new world, i.e. America, comes to the rescue of the old world.
Yeah. He knew clearly that with Dunkirk and what was to come, it was a fight for the survival of Britain.
Absolutely, there was no question about it, yes. But the only thing that we had to fight with were the planes of the RAF. That was our sole defense. If it hadn't been, to be absolutely frank, if it hadn't been for the English Channel, the Nazis would have just rolled right across and Britain would have fallen probably It may have taken a little bit longer. We may have fought harder, but there was an inevitability. The English Channel was what really initially saved us. And then, of course, the RAF.
Mm. There was a point here in this early summer of 1940 when some of Britain's leaders were thinking about, you know, making a deal with Hitler. How was it that those thoughts were put aside? How did Churchill manage to stand his ground?
In a cabinet meeting, an emergency cabinet meeting in late May of 1940, Churchill basically said to his cabinet members, either you're with me or you're not, and anybody that's not with me, they must leave the cabinet right now. And it was a test of faith. At that point, some of those, they wouldn't be called defeatists, but some of those who were for negotiation, shall I say, they were called to put up or shut up. And in fact, far from there being any debate about whether Britain should negotiate, every single member of the War Cabinet, impassioned by and emboldened by Churchill's invitation, they clamored around him, they patted him on the back, it was three cheers, hurrah, hurrah. And at that moment, Churchill knew that he had the War Cabinet behind him, and therefore he had the country behind him, at least in terms of pledging that Britain would not surrender, ever surrender, that Britain would fight right to the end.
Meanwhile, sometime earlier, following the invasion of Poland, in the States, there was a fellow by the name of Colonel Charles Sweeney,
right, a
colorful character. He sets out to begin organizing a group of Americans to join the fight against Germany. Tell us about him.
Well, actually, he probably has to go down as the most colorful, outrageous mercenary in American history. He was involved in every kind of conflict. Thankfully, on the winning side, as far as his career was concerned, from throughout the early part of the 20th century, he was actually kicked out of West Point twice. If you can believe that.
Twice,
yeah. In an interview with the New Yorker, he said, "Don't ask me why. I'll just tell you this. It was twice."
Yeah.
So he went. He then in the First World War was actually successful in setting up what was called the Escadrille Lafayette Squadron, which was a bunch of American volunteers who flew with the French in the First World War. And when war was declared in 1939, he decided that he wanted to do the same again. He wanted to form a group of Americans who would fight for the French. Unfortunately, the Americans he recruited, which include three of the characters in my book, when they got to France, they found that the French were in such disarray and the country was quickly defeated, and they therefore had to go to England, where they managed to persuade the RAF to let them fly.
Yeah. Well, when we can go back and retrace some of their steps and talk a little bit about these fellows, but when they got to the RAF, after all they'd been through, they were essentially told, go away. Well, it was the air ministry. They said, you know, well, go back, go and get some training and, you know.
Right, yes, exactly. The first place, three Americans that I actually follow in the book, all the way from Los Angeles to Montreal, then to France, and then they get out of France before the country falls to the Nazis, on the last boat, literally, to leave that country, the Baron Nairn. They get to London, they go to, first of all, the American Embassy, and Joseph Kennedy's staff say, you know, we're not interested in helping you. In fact, you're about to break neutrality laws, and we insist that you leave the country along with all other American citizens forthwith via ship from Ireland back to America, because this island is about to fall. They then left the American Embassy and went up to a policeman, a bobby, an English policeman on the street, and said, "Where are the Houses of Parliament?" The policeman pointed in the direction of the Houses of Parliament. They went there, found an MP called Robbie Robinson, who they'd been given the name of, and he managed to pull strings. He managed to, through his connections, get these guys at least an interview with a recruiting officer. In the interviews with the recruiting officer, the three Americans all lied through their teeth about their experience. They said they didn't have logbooks because they'd lost them during the chaotic flight from France. But they were experienced civilian pilots, and the RAF needed every single flyer it could get its hands on. And so these guys were waved through, and literally a month later found themselves in one of the most deadly and experienced and glamorous RAF squadrons, right at the height of the Battle of Britain. And then over the summer of 1940, from July, actually from August until the middle of September 1940, these Americans were involved in some of the fiercest air battles ever seen, well, up until that point, that had ever been known.
Oh. Had they received any combat training in the time between they show up at the British Air Ministry and the time that they find themselves in the Battle of Britain?
Very little. The official training time at that point was about a month. So someone with some flying experience could come into the RAF and a month later would be sent out to a frontline fighter squadron. These guys trained for 3 weeks. Literally, they'd only been flying the Spitfire, the fighter they were assigned, for a couple of weeks before they were in dogfights above England.
Mm. Were they good flyers?
They were very good flyers. They were exceptional flyers. To last as long as they did in those situations meant that they had to be superb pilots. They had flown extensively during the 1930s, many of these pilots. One of them was had flown over 1,800 hours. That was Art Donohue from Minnesota. They were very experienced, and they learned very fast, and in fact had their fair share of kills and equipped themselves extremely well, given that they were put a very, very difficult, nightmarish war of attrition in the air, where they literally had to fly 5 or 6 times a day in combat, in intense dogfights, and then they did that day after day after day, week after week after week, during the summer of 1940.
Yeah. And the Royal Air Force was in dire straits after the Battle of France. They didn't have much, you know, left, really, when you compare it to what the Luftwaffe had.
Sure. At the beginning, in terms of planes, the Luftwaffe outnumbered the RAF by about 5 to 1. The critical shortage for the British was not planes. They had plenty of Spitfires and Hurricanes around. The shortage was pilots who could actually fly these planes effectively in combat, take down German fighters and destroy the bombers that were coming over and pounding Britain day by day. So they basically took every pilot they could find. And in fact, throughout the Battle of Britain, there was a large contingent of foreign-born pilots. And this is something that really interested me, because in Britain it's assumed today that we did stand alone and we flew alone. But in fact, a fifth of the pilots in the Battle of Britain were foreign-born. And I think what was tantalizing about this story in some ways was that only 7 of those foreign pilots were American, and they are the only pilots that flew in the Battle of Britain who did so illegally were American. So I thought that was quite extraordinary. It becomes, in that sense, a story about outlaws, and they've always been fascinating and very American figures.
Mm. In all, over the course of the war, 244 Americans joined RAF. When did these flyers come on board?
244 U.S. citizens eventually belonged to what were called the Eagle Squadrons. So many Americans had been inspired by the heroics of the RAF during the Battle of Britain. They came over from America, and the RAF was actually able to form number 71 Squadron in the October of 1940. And then by the time of Pearl Harbor, there were 3 separate American squadrons in the RAF. I should add that those Eagle pilots, as they were known, they suffered the highest death rate of any American unit in the Second World War. Over 50% of those 244 young American men were killed, let alone wounded. Today, there are just 17 of those first combatants, American combatants in the Second World War, alive. And they're all very proud of what they did.
Yeah. I understand that you met some of these.
Sure, yeah. I went to the last ever reunion for these guys in San Diego in October, and I was actually able to sit down with four of the original Eagle pilots, these gentlemen, and shake their hand and say, hey, you know, I'm a Brit. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. And what kinds of things did they tell you about why they did it and their experiences in the war?
Well, I have to say that, you know, the most remarkable story I heard was from the widow of an Eagle pilot. And she was extremely British, a very, very well-spoken, proper lady. And she told me a remarkable story about how she'd met her husband in a nightclub in London during the Blitz, and that they'd gone below to an air raid shelter. And then she'd seen his uniform and that noticed that there was an eagle on his shoulder, and then discovered that he was an American, and just literally could not believe that there was someone as crazy enough, someone so crazy that they would come from America and join the RAF. And she was very moved by that, very attracted to this Eagle pilot. And they were married. They got married in 1942. And then she told me the story about how just 2 years later, she got the dreaded call that her husband had been shot down and nothing had been heard from him. It was assumed that he had either been killed or gone into a POW camp. And then as I was sitting in San Diego 65 years later, she says, you know, I was at work one day and I got another phone call and he was calling me. My American husband was calling me from a telephone box just over the Spanish border. He'd been able to escape from a POW camp and make his way through with the help of the French resistance all the way to Spain. And I took the phone call and he said, honey, I'll be back in a few days. Wait for me. And sure enough, he turned up 2 days later at her workplace in London, and then went back into service with the U.S. Army Air Corps. They came back to America in the late 1940s. She was one of, I think, 70,000 British women who ended up becoming GI brides who married Americans. And then has spent all of her life in America, and still seems like my grandmother, you know, as English as could be. And it's quite remarkable when you think about how dislocating that journey was for that woman. When she went to America to be with her husband in the 1940s, she knew it was a kind of death, because the likelihood of seeing her family again was very remote. Perhaps maybe once every 15, 20 years she might hope to go back to England or to see her family again. So she gave up an enormous amount to be with that American, and that was the case. You know, she really did have to give up a close relationship with her family to be with her Eagle pilot.
I hope she's had a good life here.
She's had a great life.
Good.
She loves the country, and you know, she has a profound love of both countries, and it's something that inspires me as a Brit that's lived here for quite a while.
Yeah.
It's nice to hear that the emotional complexity of having your heart in both places, you know.
Yeah, it's also a reminder that so many people gave so much.
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
Alex Kershaw is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author, most recently, of The Few, The American Knights of the Air Who Risked Everything to Fight in the Battle of Britain. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Back to Charles Sweeney. Colonel Sweeney, how did he manage? What kind of a network was he able to set up to recruit young men and get them out of the U.S.? How did it work?
He basically put up notices in various airfields around the country And it was a very discreet notice which said that a committee called the Clayton Knight Committee was looking for pirates who might be interested in foreign assignments. It was like that to avoid arousing the suspicion of the FBI. And many young men at the time, it was the late 1930s, were desperate to fly. They were poor. They didn't. They couldn't get into the U.S. Army Air Corps. They were very tantalized by these notices, and they went to secret meetings in hotels all over the states and were secretly recruited into this mercenary operation, which was codenamed the Clayton Knight Committee. And that committee arranged for these young men to be to get trains to predominantly Montreal in Canada, and then they were transported over the Atlantic at the height of the U-boat war to France and then eventually to England.
Yeah. And two of the first of these recruits that we meet in The Few, your book, are Eugene Red Tobin and Andrew Mamadoff. Tell us about them.
Eugene Tobin was a sort of wise-cracking, tall, red-haired California boy. He actually had a really nice job with MGM Studio. It was a studio pilot. And Andy Mamadoff was this sort of brooding, dark Russian character whose family had been forced to flee St. Petersburg when the Bolsheviks took power during the Russian Revolution. And they were flying friends. They flew many days together above the Sierras in California. They flew out of an airport called Mines Airport, which is now Santa Monica Airport in California. And they saw a notice on the wall in where the pilots gathered and were tantalized by this prospect and decided that they were going to answer it and answer also Adventure's call.
Yeah. They had been recruited to help Finland fight Germany.
Sure they had, and unfortunately they bought lots of winter flying gear, only to be told that the Finns had fallen to the Soviets, and therefore they'd sold their planes, they'd quit their jobs, and there they were with a bunch of winter flying gear and no war. But as Tobin later wrote, there were plenty. If you go looking for trouble, you can usually find it. And there was another war going on, which was against Poland and then against all the other European democracies as Hitler invaded Western Europe. So they went to France, tried to join the Armée de l'Air. Unfortunately, France fell, and that's how those particular guys ended up in the RAF. The last place they could go to, literally, in Europe to fly for the good guys was England.
Yeah. Now, back in California, this in part was looking like a great adventure. But as time goes on, Finland falls. They're in France, and they get out of Paris just before the Germans take the city. When did their feelings about what they were about to do, what they were really headed into, change at all?
I think it was a slow process. I think there were two turning points for Tobin. One was the first time he saw a hospital train full of wounded French troops, and the Luftwaffe had strafed the back of the train and destroyed most of the carriages. And Tobin saw that literally as he was waiting for a train to Paris. This awful spectacle rolled into the train station, and it deeply shocked him. He realized that, as he later wrote, he wasn't just there to get behind 1,500 horsepower. There was something else going on here. And I think the second time that he was profoundly moved and changed, and I think this is the case with all of the men I write about, was that when they were flying above England with young British men, average age of 22, they could sense the emotion that these men felt. Their compatriots, usually 12 to a squadron, when they flew up together as a group, they were fighting to defend their way of life, their families living below, in often in towns that they could see from the air and that they fought above. And this was particularly obviously affecting for these Americans. And very quickly they shared the emotional devotion of their fellow pilots. And when their fellow pilots started to die, and they died like flies during the summer of 1940, they felt a very deep sadness and grief and commitment to revenge. They wanted to avenge the deaths of these young friends of theirs, guys who they'd become very close to, who they'd helped save in life and death situations on a daily basis. They were consumed with the idea of taking down a German for every friend that they lost.
Yeah. How did the RAF flyers feel about the Americans?
Loved them to death, and they were very, very welcome. And you can imagine these wisecracking, poker-playing guys turn up with suitcases full of Bing Crosby records, cracking, you know, trying to have a laugh whenever they possibly could during this moment of deep crisis for Britain. And the British people and their fellow pilots knew that these guys were obviously American and that America was neutral, and that America, unless America woke up and came to Britain's aid, the Second World War would be lost. So you can imagine how popular these American guys were, because they didn't have to be there, and yet they were there to help save my country.
When did people in the States learn of these young American men who were flying in the RAF and who had flown in the Battle of Britain?
There were news stories in local newspapers around America actually during the battle. You know, a local newspaper would report that, say, Andy Mamadoff from Thompson, Connecticut, he was, he's a pilot in the RAF flying in the Battle of Britain. So during the Battle of Britain, there were several news reports where the wave, the massive wave of publicity, when that really swept across America, was when the Eagle pilots went into operation, when they went actually into action in January of 1941. There was a movie made called The Eagle Squadron. Every single foreign correspondent in England at the time was interviewing any Eagle pilot he could find, because obviously it was a really smashing story. Here was America neutral. These wild cowboys from America had given up their citizenship to go and fight in this very thrilling and very compelling battle.
Mm. Let's talk about another one of the seven, Vernon Charles Keogh, the shortest man to fly with the RAF.
Yes, when the during a scramble, these pilots would go, would become operational just before dawn every day, and a black telephone, Bakelite telephone, there would be a small click before that telephone rang, and then the telephone signaled a scramble, which meant that the pilots had to get into the air as quickly as possible. Now, every morning, Shorty Keogh, 4'10", he would sit there waiting for that telephone to ring with two cushions under his arms. He was so short that he had to be helped up into his Spitfire, and then he had to sit on one cushion to be able to see through the cockpit, and had to have the other cushion there to prop him up by his back. He was the shortest pilot ever to fly in the RAF. I don't think there's been a shorter pilot before or since Shorty Keogh. And he actually introduced himself on first meeting as Shorty. He was happy to be called Shorty.
Yeah, wasn't it Tobin or Mamadoff who gave him that nickname?
No, I think
he came with it.
He introduced himself. I don't mind if you call me she.
I'm sure if you were 4'10", you'd get used to that kind of thing. You might as well just adopt it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. He was a remarkable guy, because the reason some people thought it was a not obviously correct, but some people thought that he was so short because he'd been injured during a parachuting accident and had crushed a couple of vertebrae. He was actually one of America's first great skydivers. In the 1930s, he was one of the first skydivers. Completed, I think, over 500 jumps from just a couple of hundred feet sometimes during the 1930s, when he was part of a barnstorming outfit.
Hmm. And another of the seven, Arthur Art Donahue from Minnesota. You want to tell us a little story about him?
I can tell you that I went back to St. Charles, Minnesota, where he grew up, and I was on a book tour, and I met several people who remembered him vividly. They remember on county fair day paying him a very small amount of money at that time, but it was enough to be able to get up into a plane with Art Donahue, and they remember vividly still to this day what a good pilot he was and how much fun he was. He was a devout Catholic, thought about becoming a priest, decided that he was going to devote his life instead to flying, the youngest commercial pilot in Minnesota history. And actually, of the seven Americans I write about, he was the only ace. He was the only guy that ended up with five confirmed kills. And he had the great honor also of being the first American to lead an RAF squadron in its history. He became squadron leader of 92 Squadron in September of 1942, and unfortunately just a month later was shot down and killed over the northern waters of the English Channel on a dawn patrol.
Mm. The first to die was a fellow that we talked about a little bit earlier, Chicago-born William Meade Fisk, the Olympian, a golden boy.
Absolutely, and he was actually at the time it was thought that he was the first American pilot to die in the Second World War. That's certainly how the news was tagged when it arrived back in America and when actually was telegraphed around the world. Here was this young, dashing, two-time gold medal winner, youngest ever gold medal winner, who'd given his life at the height of the Battle of Britain to save England. He was shot down and horrifically burnt. He survived for about 18 hours, but eventually the shock caused to his body by very, very extensive burns killed him.
Mm. Did the Germans realize they were flying against Americans as well as...
Later on, they did, yes. Mm. During 1941, they realized that they were up against the American Eagle squadrons, because the story was so international and it was obviously reported all around the world on every wire service and every newspaper. And the German embassy in Washington, for example, America was still neutral. Germans could walk around Washington, New York, in fact, anywhere in America and say and do what they wanted. And they were very aware that these guys were being covered in the American press, almost ad nauseam. It was hard to pick up a magazine in 1941 and not read an article about the Eagle squadrons. So, yes, the German propaganda ministry knew about the Americans, and the German pilots did too.
Yeah. What kind of men were the German pilots? We're talking about them. We've talked about them sort of as a group here, but they were individual flyers as well.
I was struck by that very question. It's a very good question, because it goes to the heart of a lot of what my book's about, which is that what unified both sides was a love of flying. This passion had been perverted into combat. The passion for flying had led these guys into the air to try and kill each other, which was a great tragedy. But on both sides, They were remarkably similar. They were often middle class, fairly well educated. They'd grown up wanting to do only one thing, which was to fly, had the same kind of rituals, the same kind of camaraderie, often obviously the same kind of humor, and really the same kind of code of ethics during the battle. It was not done by either side to shoot a guy in a parachute. You also didn't shoot at a guy who was in the water who'd had to ditch in the English Channel, and you certainly didn't shoot at a guy who'd got out of his crashed airplane and was on the ground. There were rules of engagement that were very honorable compared to other battles during the Second World War.
Yeah. And early in the book, this comes across a little bit when you talk about Dunkirk And some of the German pilots just in their fill of it. It was horrible.
Well, absolutely. I think at one point around 250,000 British troops were waiting on the beaches of Dunkirk to be pulled off by any kind of ship that was able to cross the channel. And the German pilots would simply fly above these armies of men. They looked like armies of ants from the sky, and strafe them, literally, you know, fly down to 200 feet and open up with the machine guns and strafe men. And they'd do that all day long. So, yes, that did obviously sicken a few of them.
Back to the love of flying. Love of flying is where things start. Perhaps seeing what is at stake is also important to these men. Their love of flying leads them to their love for one another and the great loyalty that developed between them. That's really a huge part of this story, isn't it?
Well, I think so, definitely. I think in any small unit in that goes into combat, there's definitely are very strong bonds created between those men, bonds that at the time perhaps felt stronger than anything they'd experienced before in their lives, including their marriages, their love affairs, even with their own siblings. Very, very strong bonds. I think when you know that you can die any moment, and in fact it seems obvious that you will soon die, the closeness and the appreciation of what another man's friendship means was enormously intense.
Yeah. Well, we see that today. I read a story not too long ago about a soldier killed in Iraq who had volunteered for the military, hoping to improve her life and the life that she was hoping to provide her very young daughter. So she was hoping to go to school, and she wound up in Iraq. And while her motivation to join the military was to better her life, she didn't plan on becoming a soldier per se. She became a very good soldier.
Right. Well, people who are put into these situations, you see the best and the worst of humankind. You see people rise to heights you'd never imagine, but also on the other hand. It involves killing, you know. It's the great tragic irony of war.
Yeah. What's next for you?
I'm writing a book about a bunch of guys on a submarine in the Pacific. They managed to escape the sinking of their to survive the sinking of their submarine, and then also survive really quite terrible experiences at the hands of the Japanese. But so that's what I'm working on now, and after that, I think I'm done for a while. I'm going to write a biography of Zinedine Zidane, maybe, or some soccer star.
Well, very good. Well, perhaps we'll talk again. I would enjoy that.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Alex Kershaw has been my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author most recently of The Few, The American Knights of the Air, Who Risked Everything to Fight in the Battle of Britain. The book is published by DeCapo Press.